Good morning and welcome to Shattering This. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive and the deadliness that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission here is to understand what is occurring behind the headlines and trying to predict how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we will engage God on His terms, which is through evidence and reason, not through faith or belief, since His is the lone reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Over the next 2 hours, you're welcome, in fact, you're encouraged to participate in this discussion. Our number is 877-300-7645. I promised yesterday that we would move back to a topic that we began discussing several weeks ago, probably now fully a month ago, and that I think we have wrung all that there is to wring out of the vilification of George Zimmerman and the sanctification of Trayvon Martin and people's moronic responses to what happened that night. And so what I would like to do is return to what I thought was the most important media story of the last month, which is a USA Today. It's hard for me to say that because having traveled a fair amount of time in my life, USA Today was always interesting only in that it had nice pictures and a colorful presentation, but hard news it was not. But nonetheless, the most important story, I think, over the last maybe 6 months was the roundtable discussion that USA Today published regarding the individuals who had gone before Snowden, who were, unlike Snowden, who was a not even an employee of the NSA, but was a contract worker and was reasonably novice in his position. These individuals had been with the NSA for a prolonged period of time. They were relatively senior. They had actually designed the software that collects information indiscriminately on Americans and people around the world, as opposed to just knowing that it existed because of management of the databases. They had a similar conviction. They knew that what they were doing was unconstitutional. They knew that it was extraordinarily wrong. They knew that if the NSA was not stopped from doing this, if they continued to do it, it would have devastating consequences for the American people. They not only risked their jobs, they all lost their jobs. They only risked their reputations. They all had their reputations trashed by the U.S. government for doing the same thing Snowden did, which was to expose the malfeasance, the criminal activity of the U.S. government. The difference was that these individuals knew what they were doing was wrong, but they did not have the wholesale pass to all data that a systems administrator has, and therefore they could not produce the murder weapon. They couldn't produce the smoking gun Snowden did. So we're going to return to that discussion. The question that we were considering when last we were on this topic before the George Zimmerman verdict was pronounced was, does Congress provide oversight for these programs? Now, this was the statement that when it was exposed, the President of the United States and the Director of National Security, Mr. Clapper, said, hey, you know, don't blame us. The Congress is fully aware of these programs. They have reviewed them. They've approved them. They, you know, we're not doing this in a vacuum. They have been court approved and all of this sort of thing, as if that was actually a meaningful process. These men revealed that it was not. It's all a charade. Congress has been the rubber stamp. The judicial branch has been shut down from hearing these cases because every time they do, they are told that the people who are challenging these programs either have no standing or that they are covered by the state's secrets privilege, and therefore it would be a breach of national security to even try the case. and the government says that they can't go forward. So the judges are hamstrung, and the government literally says, no, there will be no judicial proceedings. So the Justice Department is literally shut down when it isn't conspiring on behalf of the government. So the idea that we have robust checks and balances is a complete myth. Benny, who is one of the insiders who tried to share this information, then said, but the way that it's set up now, it is a complete joke. It can't work the way it is now because they have no real way of seeing into those agencies and what they are doing. They are basically dependent, wholly dependent, on the agencies briefing them on the programs, telling them what they're doing. But they are lying to them, as Clapper demonstrated. And there is the crux of the issue. Congress is being lied to by those who are in the business of keeping secrets. Those in the business of confiscating others' secrets and keeping secrets are lying to the Congress. And so the Congress has no way to know what is actually occurring. When the Congress asked Clapper, National Security Director, about whether or not the government was, the NSA in particular, was indiscriminately spying on thousands of Americans, he said no. Well, if thousands is a subset of millions, the answer was yes. He subsequently apologized and said, yeah, I lied. Now, that happens to be perjury. You're sworn to oath when you testify before Congress. Why isn't Clapper being sent, being incarcerated, being arraigned, being tried for perjury? Why are we after Snowden, who is the individual who alerted us to the fact that the U.S. government was being, was acting criminally relative to its constitution? Why are we going after him, calling him a fugitive from justice, when the actual people who perpetrated this crime and lied about it, perjured themselves, are still being paid by the U.S. government? Now, Benny goes on to say, he said the only way that that this could be corrected, the fact that Congress is misinformed, would be to create a billets. A billet is a military term. It's a garrison, a camp, or a base on these committees, and integrate people into them who are in these agencies so that they have access and thereby observe what's happening. So what he's saying is that the oversight committees, which would be the Senate Intelligence Committee, would have to have a staff, a full-time staff, that was employed both by the NSA and by the Congress, whose job it would be to be the constant eyes into the NSA for the Congress. Now, that's assuming that these individuals would be given access by the NSA to anything important, which, of course, they wouldn't. And he says they could, thereby, provide the feedback as to what's going on. Now, instead, all those charged with oversight, all they know is that the NSA or other agencies, whatever it is that they tell them, they know nothing more. And their mindset is to spy using clandestine means, to bribe and to manipulate, to keep secrets, not to trust anyone. So the very people who are reporting this information are professionals at bribing. That's how our intelligence works in America. We bribe people to provide information to us, to manipulate them by trying to catch them in some indiscriminate act that can be used over their head to get them to fess up information, to keep secrets and not to trust anyone. They know that they're not trustworthy, and therefore they don't trust anyone, and therefore they're not about to disclose what they're doing. Even take FISA, Benny said. That court, this Foreign Intelligence Court. He says the judges signed the order. The FBI swore on an affidavit to the judge. These are the reasons why we need every record that Verizon has, for example. But the judge has absolutely no foundation to challenge anything presented to him. There is no opposing side. There's no side representing the people. You know, this is not a judge where he's getting two sides and he's ruling based upon the opposing views where one side has the opportunity to refute the other. He's only getting one side. And he has no basis whatsoever to know whether or not that's reasonable.
So you mean a one-sided argument is easy to win?
Evidently, because guess what? Without a dissenting view, this court has never voted against, never signed an edict against the government. Every request the government has made has been approved. So tell me, how is that a check and balance? Raddick said.
It's not. My answer was silence.
Yeah, I recognize that. Raddick said, the proof is that in the last year alone, in 2012, the secret court approved 1,856 applications. Do you know how many they denied? Zero. That was the game. You know, I guess they don't have the mercy rule in the U.S. government, you know, in Little League, which I had the enjoyment of playing and coaching. If you're up by 10 runs, they impose the mercy rule. This game was 1,856 to zero. And so you're telling me that this court is somehow a checked and balanced? No. Smoke and mirrors, folks. He went on to say, and that is typical from everything that has happened in previous years. I know the government has been asserting that all of this is kosher and legitimate because the FISA court signed off on it. The FISA court is a secret court. It operates in secret. There's only one side, and they have never disapproved anything. Question. Do you think that President Obama fully knows and understands what the NSA is doing? Benny said, no. He said, it's obvious. The Congress doesn't either. They're all being told what I call technobabble. And they, the lawmakers, don't really understand it. And what the NSA does, they don't know what it does. They don't know how it operates. And even when they get the briefings, they still don't understand them. Back in the day when I was in business and had taken my last company public, I had access to many congressmen and senators and even presidents. And I met with senators, congressmen, and presidents privately and often. And I can tell you that I seldom met anyone that I would consider especially intelligent. There were some that were reasonably well-informed, but very few that I would talk to that I would say, boy, that person not only understands and knows, but also exercises good moral decision-making and judgment. Just not there. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm going to conclude just this one thought, then we're going to move on to Nick, who's calling in from Wisconsin on a different topic. But having met so many leading politicians in America and having engaged them privately in conversation, I can tell you that for the most part, they are not the sharpest individuals. And, you know, raw intelligence isn't the big issue. The big issue is how well-informed are they, and are they capable of processing information in a rational way and making moral decisions? And what I have found is that is an extraordinarily rare commodity amongst politicians. I have not met one who could do all three of those things, who would fit into all three of those categories. I've met some bright ones. I've met some that are well-informed. I've met some that could process information rationally. But in terms of making good moral decisions based on what the issues were, I have not met any. And so most people are successful in politics because they look good. They speak in a way that prevails with the listeners, and they're effective on television as communicators to an audience that is not well-informed. And so when somebody comes out who is well-informed, who is judgmental, who is moral, they sound so screeching by comparison to all of the lies that we're fed, they're not electable. And so Congress is not capable of making these kinds of decisions. Now, that said, I want to welcome Nick to the program. Hello, Nick. It's always good to hear from you.
Good morning. Did you hear about the movie The Innocence of Islamic Jihad?
I've heard of the movie. The movie is called The Innocent Prophet. That was a movie that was produced by a fellow known as Imran Farisat. He's the Pakistani who had to flee from Pakistan for his life when he converted from Islam to Christianity, and he went to Spain, which granted him asylum. And then in Spain, he was prosecuted for a hate crime for the movie The Innocent Prophet. Is that the fellow you're talking about?
Yeah. Was he ever deported from Spain? I browsing the internet and nothing about him. Was he killed or what happened to him?
Seeing what you had, the question that you brought up during the commercial break, I was able to use the old internet and Googled deported from. Yeah, and here's what the first article that came up for me was. I want to share it with you because I think it's really interesting. Well, and let's chat about it. And if we go through the break, I hope you can stay with me because his story is really germane to this program, and it should be interesting to our audience. This is an article that was written on June 27th, about 3 weeks ago, 2013. It says, although Imran Farisat was acquitted on a hate crime, charged which was tied to his movie The Innocent Prophet, he continues to face the possibility of being deported from Spain back to Pakistan. He warns that if that happens, he will face death under Sharia, which is absolutely true. It's a shame that journalists aren't more aware. If he goes back to an Islamic country, he will absolutely be killed. The Quran says, and I believe it's in the fourth surah, if a Muslim abrogates his faith, kill him. So the Quran, which Muslims have been hoodwinked into believing is from their God, specifically says, and this could have been written, he will face death under the Quran, that he will be killed, absolutely for certain. Farisat converted from Islam to Christianity in 2004. Now, my view is that to go from one terrible religion to another errant religion is not progress. But nonetheless, I'm a free will sort of a guy. If somebody wishes to go from ding-dongs to Hostess Twinkies, that's their choice. But he did convert from Islam to Christianity, and doing so in the world of Islam, in any country controlled by Muslims, doing that is a guarantee of being killed.
So then, Spain is not Islam, but they know that he will be killed. Why would they deport him?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the reason is that if that's all that had happened and he came to Spain and didn't do anything, that'd been one thing. But in Spain, when he produced this movie called The Innocent Prophet, who's, by the way, anything but innocent. He is the most reprehensible man who ever lived. He was a pedophile, a rapist, a slave trader, a kidnapper, a mass murderer, a ruthless terrorist. So if you think those things are bad, then Muhammad was a bad man. When he produced that movie, Muslims sought to have him incarcerated for a hate crime. Now, what's amazing is he actually prevailed, because typically in hate crimes, Nick, the truth is not an alibi. That's how the hate crimes even that we're going to see manifest in America after the George Zimmerman verdict. Truth is not an alibi, but yet he prevailed. We'll be back with Nick and Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Nick on the line with us. He has asked about a Christian refugee from Pakistan and whether or not he's going to be deported back from Spain to Pakistan as a result of producing a movie called The Innocent Prophet. And, it's interesting, Nick, you and I have talked a lot over this last year. And one of the things that is undeniable is that if you take the five oldest sources of Islam, the Quran, the Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, the Tariq, which is the history of Islam's formation, and the two most revered hadith collections that are compiled by Topic, Bukhari and Muslims, if you take those five sources and you put them together in chronological order, what you find is that that the primary, the overwhelming preponderance of the information reveals that Muhammad was a ruthless terrorist, that he was a pedophile, that he was a rapist, that he was a kidnapper, slave trader, mass murderer, and that he took great glee in torturing people. He was also a thief. And so it is impossible to study the oldest Islamic sources and to come to any conclusion other than if you view those traits, murder, rape, pedophilia, incest, slave trading, kidnapping, mass murder, if you view those things as being bad, then Muhammad was repulsive. And so and the worst thing about Muhammad, of course, is he claimed to be a conduit of God, a God named Allah, who made claims that his Quran revelation confirmed the Torah, when in fact it's the antithesis of it. So he misled billions of people. If you're going to do a movie on the man's life and it's going to be accurate, it's going to be extraordinarily demeaning. And so the this is a story, and I want to share a little bit of it with you, because it is interesting that Daniel Pipes, who is someone that I have never been fond of, because Daniel Pipes constantly promotes this idea of an Islamic Reformation and of moderate Islam, which is an absolute fable, and it is unbelievably irritating for a man who knows better to be promoting these myths. But to his credit, it is Daniel Pipes and his legal project of the Middle East Forum that has been working on Imran Firasat's behalf, and was the reason that he was exonerated from the hate crime charge. This is what Front Page Magazine, which Daniel Pipes is a big part of, has to say. Spain has begun deportation proceedings against Imran Firasat. Hey, Chris, so this now answers your particular question. They have begun deportations proceedings against him, a Christian refugee from Pakistan, for making a documentary film about Muhammad and thereby threatening the national security of Spain. If Firasat is deported back to Pakistan, he will face the death penalty, proving that it's a very short step from the Spanish Inquisition to the Pakistani Inquisition. The United States also has a man sitting in prison for making another blasphemous movie, which the government spent weeks blaming for worldwide attacks on American embassies. And he isn't the first man prosecuted or persecuted
for
offending Islam.
Something else, but yeah, we all know.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. They put him in jail for some technicality on some minor issue. And, the issue that he was, which was basically a civil issue, was a banking-related issue, you don't get put in jail for that. If you are arrested, you post bond and you're free. And then you face trial at a later date. No, he's put in the slammer.
It's something similar to what communists in Russia.
Correct.
At each point you're in violation of some law that you
correct.
Know.
Right, and they don't have to produce any evidence. The U.S. government put him in jail over this. They don't have to produce any evidence. The offending Islam has become, this article reads, a national security issue involving all levels of governments around the world. They're afraid that if somebody defends Islam, Muslims will go berserk. Now, this is interesting. When Bubba the Love Sponge, now when I ever say that name, and most people just laugh, Bubba the Love Sponge. Bubba the Love Sponge, amongst the 2000 talk radio show hosts that I interviewed on after I wrote Tea with Terrace and Prophet of Doom, one of the very brightest, one of the best read, one of the most reasonable, rational individuals I have ever had the pleasure of interviewing with. He uses Bubba the Love Sponge just kind of as a self-effacing title. But Bubba the Love Sponge, a Tampa DJ, proposed to burn a Quran. When he did so, the commander of the Afghanistan war contacted his girlfriend. He was married, by the way. He contacted his girlfriend, who would later be stalked by Petraeus' girlfriend, to contact the mayor of Tampa to keep Bubba from burning the Quran. Instead of explaining how the American systems works to the Lebanese temptress, her and her four-star general, the mayor wrote back that the city was working on it. Imagine that. Mm. That month, 50% more Americans were killed in Afghanistan in the long, slow death march of that war. But a Quran was not burned in Tampa. Mission accomplished. Muslims did not have to kill a great number of Americans to enforce blasphemy. Counting the various reactions to burnt Qurans, rumors of flushed Qurans, and assorted things of that nature, the number is still well below 100, even counting every casualty in the war from September 11th onward. It took fewer deaths to make the United States give up on its Bill of Rights than it took to liberate it in the War of Independence.
Time
well, that's brilliant
time
writing.
You have, time to time, you have a guest over there.
IQ Arasuli.
Uh-huh. Do you think maybe he would know something about this?
I think no one in America actually would know more about him. I am positive because IQ Arasuli maintains contact with all these people. He lives in Europe. This man is in Spain. I will send him an email, and in fact, I'll even ask him about it on Friday. Tomorrow he'll be on the program in the second hour, so I'm going to ask him specifically. But the organization that appears to be on top of this is the Middle East Forum and Daniel Pipes, again. Pains me to recommend Daniel Pipes because while he does and says many good things, he is committed to promoting the myth that an Islamic reformation would be a good thing. We're seeing the fruit of Islamic reformation right now in Egypt and in Syria. A reformation means they go back to the original. Going back to original Islam is devastating. And
now I have another question on a different subject, and I'll hang up then and listen to your answer offline. And that is about religion and why is it wrong to take the bad parts out from, well, even though it is a wrong religion,
yes,
let's say a Christian or a Muslim, but I would rather than to take all the crap out from them and just live the peaceful and
okay. Let's take Christianity for example. Let's take Christianity for a moment. What would you take? That's Islam. We're talking about Islam. If you were to take the bad parts of Islam out, which would be everything. There is no Islam left. Okay. Now let's say that you take all of the bad parts of Christianity and you're left with kind of Paul's rhetoric. Let's say you're even left with Yosha's words and example. Well, if you're left with Yosha's words and example, well then you're going to be Torah observant. If you're Torah observant, you can't be religious. If you're left with Paul's stuff, then you're dealing with, is it appropriate to follow a mantra that is internally self-contradictory? You know, what you end up with, Nick, is that if you want to have your own personal life value system, you're far better off having just develop your own wholly apart from the religious muck. So rather than trying to remove all that is wrong from the existing religions, if that is your goal, is you want to create your own value system, then you're better off just developing it on your own. But I will tell you that if there is such a value system now, and it happens to be the most deadly in the world, socialist secular humanism chose to remove all religion from their value system and to make man really the center of the universe, and enlighten men the highest form of reverence. And socialist secular humanism, which touts peace and touts equality and this sort of thing, is the most deadly religion ever conceived. They've killed a couple of 100 million people over the last 100 years.
What I also hear a lot from Islam defense is that they say that Islam is a second worldwide second biggest religion worldwide. And if so, then how is it possible for that many people to believe in Islam if it's a religion?
Yeah, you know, it's the direct answer to your question is during the height of the Roman Empire, the Roman paganism was the most popular religion in the world. Did that make Roman paganism right? The most popular religion in the USSR and the most popular religion in communist China is secular humanism. Does that make secular humanism right just because 90% of the people adhere to it? Roman Catholicism was the universal religion of Europe for better part of 1,000 years. And you were either Roman Catholic, you pledged your allegiance to Roman Catholicism, or they killed you. Does that make Roman Catholicism true?
Thank you very much for answering my questions. I'll hang up now and listen offline.
Okay. My pleasure, Nick. And I also want to just thank Nick for he made a call in the program end of last week when we were talking about a different topic in our second hour, and very politely called back in again and said, you know, this topic is interesting, and my topic would be distracting. I'll call back in another day. I've come to like and respect Nick for lots of reasons, that being one of them. When we return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break, we will continue to go back to the story that we were covering relative to Spygate and why it is that the person that did us the great favor, liberating us from tyranny, is being sought for persecution, and those that committed the crime are being paid by the U.S. government. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. In the last few minutes, I'd like to conclude some of our thoughts here on Spygate. Benny was asked, what should Edward Snowden expect now from the U.S. government? And he says, well, first of all, I think he should be expected to be treated just like Bradley Manning. He's the Army private now being court-martialed for linking the documents to WikiLeaks, which were so beneficial to Americans. And unfortunately, the government is prosecuting him. The U.S. government, if it gets a hold of Snowden, that's how he will be treated. Benny then went on to say, after the question, will he be prosecuted? He said, first, he'll probably be tortured. Then he'll be even rendered and tortured and incarcerated and then tried and incarcerated and perhaps even executed over this crime. The U.S. government does not play nicely. I mean, the U.S. government now has CIA squads and places around the world that they torture individuals. I mean, there was a German case that I reported on this program of a man that was captured in Macedonia where mistaken identity, and yet he was sodomized for months by the U.S. government, and he was wholly innocent. So, yeah, that's what the United States would likely do. Drake said, I'm Exhibit 1. He says, I was charged with 10 felony counts. I was facing 35 years in prison. For doing what? For revealing that the U.S. government is acting in a criminal fashion. That's how far the state will go to punish you out of retaliation and reprisal and retribution. Since my life has been changed, it has been turned upside down and inside out. I lived on the blunt end of the surveillance bubble. When you are faced, essentially, with the rest of your life in prison, you really begin to understand and appreciate how at least more than I ever have before in terms of my oath to support the U.S. Constitution and how those who are violating the U.S. Constitution want to take those rights and freedoms away. Believe me, they're going to put everything they have to get him. I think he's at great risk, and he will eventually be pulled off the street. Raddick said, we have already unleashed the full force of the entire executive branch against him and are now doing a worldwide manhunt to bring him in. Of course, they know where he is now. And so they're coercing nations around the world to turn him in. And it turned out to be it's just an unbelievable disaster politically for the United States. I mean, we've showed the world that the United States is not for truth. The United States is not an advocate of freedom. The United States is not to be trusted. that we're a manipulative country, that when our flaws are revealed, that we retaliate, that we're mean, we're spiteful, that we should never be trusted to form a relationship with. That is what we have proven to the world, that we are a nation that has become wholly hypocritical, believing one thing and doing the opposite. He says, I heard a number of people in Congress say he should be charged with treason, charged with espionage, crime acts. So there are obviously the most serious offenses that can be leveled against an American. And the people who have thus far faced them have never intended to harm the U.S. or benefit the foreign nations that have always wanted to have this information. In the case of Snowden, he didn't benefit financially. He could have. He didn't disclose any information that was harmful to the American people, and he could have. What he revealed was embarrassing to the U.S. government because it shows that the leaders of the of America, its national security leaders, its military leaders, its political leaders, are corrupt, that they're criminals, that they will lie and do lie, that they will perjure themselves, and that they view Americans as the threat. The new enemy, according to the NSA, is average Americans. And what the NSA doesn't want Americans to know is that they are spying on them because they don't trust them. And that the NSA doesn't want Americans to know, nor does this government want people to know, that it is the leaders of the government who have acted criminally and who have not honored their oath to support the U.S. Constitution. And when you live in a land that does not abide by its foundational document, then you live in a country that is built on quicksand. It will take almost nothing to topple this nation because it is now a facade, a house of cards built on the shifting sands and the winds that are blowing are the lies of its politicians. We should expect the worst. And it's all been revealed and laid out before us by the great gift that was given to us by Edward Snowden. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break.